And good morning to everyone. It's Saturday, the goodness, it's the second day of July 2016, and this is the Mideast Migraines Program. Launching CDU Deck 2.
منن يا أمان وفي وصالة وفي وصالة أنت المدلل يا أمان وفي وصالة وفي وصالة أنا متيلة يا
You've been listening to the album Crossing Borders. In this concert, recorded live in Minneapolis on September 12, 1993, Crossing Borders and Jordanian artist Sakhir Hattar perform classical Arab music from Syria, Egypt, Lebanon, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and 13th century Andalusia. In December 1993, Sakhir won first place in the international competition of Arab instruments, in which 16 Arab nations participated. For his solo performance of Samai Shadaraban, also on this recording, on the oud, Samai Shadaraban, I was just looking at that. That would be, where'd you go? Well, anyway, Sakir Hattar is an instructor at the National Music Conservatory in Amman, Jordan, where he first met Russell Packard. Ah, yes, I remember Russell Packard. Director of Crossing Borders. Russell enrolled in the conservatory in 1989 and received private instruction from Sakir, observed him directing Firkat Fuhais, and learned many of the arrangements performed in this concert. Crossing Borders is a world music ensemble that performs music from many cultures, including North and South America, the Middle East, Africa, Scandinavia, Ireland, and India. Yeah, for me, Russell has a very distinct voice, and a few times on this CD, he exclaims something in Arabic. He and I go way back, but it's not like we were really close. Okay, specifically the last item you heard, track 5, You Can Do What You Want, composed by Komel Khalai. And before that, we begun the show with Everything I See in You is Beautiful, a song done in the tradition of Moshahad, a classical music form stemming from the 13th century in Andalusia. Welcome again. My name is Lawrence Ren Tawil, your local friendly Palestinian-American here in Santa Cruz County, California, on the Central Coast, just a tad south of San Francisco. A tad, like, what, 70 miles? And you are listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting at 101.3 on the FM dial, and streaming live, once again, streaming live at freakradio.org. Please visit our website at freakradio.org. In it you will find Band-Aids, throat lozenges, high gloss lipstick, stockings for women. Oh, wait a minute, that's the wrong that's the wrong motion picture soundtrack there. Now go to freakradio.org. In it you will find our schedule of our 24/7 radio broadcasting service. We are an unlicensed pirate radio service. We are not beholden to the FCC by choice and by effort. Free Radio Santa Cruz is an ongoing expression of civil disobedience and nonviolence in opposition to the governmental and corporate influences that would otherwise be restraining our editorial position and our output. This is the Mideast Migraines program for a Saturday, July 2, 2016. A homegrown product of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to read to you just something that I've been carrying around in my briefcase for many months, actually. From the American Friends Service Committee. Reducing the military budget is the best legacy we can leave for coming generations. And here's a quotation from President Dwight D. Eisenhower. Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. The words of Republican President Eisenhower from the 1950s. For you kids out there, he reigned from 1953 to 1961. Support the pro-peace work of the American Friends Service Committee, the AFSC, and join our 1 Minute for Peace campaign. What is meant by that? The American Friends Service Committee seeks to raise the equivalent of 1 minute of what the military spent in 1 year. $1.2 million in a minute, folks. The military spent $1.2 million. This is our 1 Minute for Peace campaign. I don't want to give anyone the impression that I'm a member of AFSC, but I may as well read this background information. For more information, visit their website at oneminuteforpeace.org. oneminuteforpeace.org. Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Just how much of our money, our taxpayer paid money, was requested for the military this year? 2015, I've been carrying this around so long, it's for the 2015, last year's proposed discretionary spending. This is an unfoldable or foldable sheet of paper here, which is about 4 inches wide and a good 2 feet long, to make the budget quite visible. Just over halfway across this long piece of paper here is the color red, military, which is to say Department of Defense, War and Nuclear Weapons Programs, 55% of discretionary spending, which Congress is responsible, Congress and its various committees are responsible for, proposed discretionary spending for last year, 55% for the military. That is followed by the next highest item, which is education. 6.2%. Now, that's 6.2% compared to 55, well over half of the total budget for the United States and its citizens. 6.2% for education, 5.6 for veterans benefits, 5.5 for government, the running of the government, 5.3 for housing and community, 4.9 for health. Folks, 4.9 for the health of the citizen compared to 55% of something very unhealthy, ultimately. The military. You know, that effort for peace, all essentially the justification being the mad philosophy, mutually assured destruction, as far as I'm concerned. Health, 4.9. Labor, 4.8. International affairs, 3.3. And I believe that portion of the budget, international affairs, includes the more than $3 billion. $3 billion is roughly 3% of the federal budget, which goes to Israel every year. All earmarked. Every bit of that, more than $3 billion a year, earmarked for Israel's own military. And that falls under the subcategory of foreign aid. I'm guessing that's a part of international affairs. And then energy and the environment, 3%. Science, 2.5%. Transportation, 2.3%. Think of the gridlock. Think of the still horribly lagging behind state of public transit, including passenger rail, whether it's full-fledged commuter trains, Amtrak, light rail, or whatever. 2.3% of the whole budget is transportation. And then they've squeezed in 1% for food and agriculture. Now, I remember an earlier version of this vivid expression of the federal budget, including NASA, which, as I recall, was only 1%, 1 or 2%. They don't even include NASA as a separate category here. Maybe that's under science now, which is 2.5. This, by the way, is based on President Obama's 2015 federal discretionary budget request, which was sent to Congress in March of 2014, over 2 years ago. Percentages are rounded to create this image. Percentages. You know, some of you have gotten this in the mail, requesting donations for the American Friends Service Committee. Truly, truly sad situation. Okay. Put that away for now. This is the Mideast Migraine Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz, which does come to you every Saturday at 11 a.m., 1100 hours Pacific time, Pacific Daylight Time. Not to be confused with the other separately produced expression of Mideast Migraines every Monday at 1500 hours. That's 3 o'clock in the afternoon Pacific time on Mondays. 3 o'clock p.m. on Mondays. Okay. Last week, I completed the reading of a pamphlet entitled The Origin of the Palestine-Israel Conflict. Now, you cannot just go and pick up any old booklet or book or pamphlet or brochure which says, with the title or a similar title to The Origin of the Palestine-Israel Conflict. There are so many out there, from hardbound books to flimsy brochures with that same basic title or something close to it. This specifically, Origin of the Palestine-Israel Conflict, third edition, including Intifada 2000, was published by Jews for Justice in the Middle East and is distributed by If Americans Knew. If you're interested in your own copy or copies, you can go to ifamericansknew.org or their email address, contact@ifamericansknew.org. It's also available through the Council for the National Interest.org, councilforthenationalinterest.org, or contact, or send an email to contact@cnionline.org. CNI is Council for the National Interest. Again, email for them is contact@cnionline.org. You also have the option of going to my archives, which are located at the website radioforall.net. That's radio, the digital number 4, ALL.net, radioforall.net. Type Mideast Migraines into the search box, and you will see a listing of my programs, exclusively my programs, coming to you from FRSC. And in the case of the readings from the booklet, which took me a good 4 or 5 or so Saturdays to complete, would be marked on the archives with the title something like O of PIC, capital O of capital P, capital I, capital C. segments of the readings, try to get those in chronological order, in order of date. Of course, the oldest date is the first chapters of the book. Now, okay, I have made a big deal about how since November of 2013, when the show was about almost a year and a half old, I was making it a point to read entire books on the Saturday edition of Mideast Migraines and leave the Monday edition to other news items and various and sundry items, dispatches, and stuff related to the Palestine-Israel conflict. Of course, we've been on the air, both transmitting and online, for most of that time, since I began the book readings and before. FRSC, by the way, is well over 21 years old now. We've been liberating the airwaves, as we put it, since 1995. We were even raided once by the Federal Communications Commission for our oh-so-dastardly crime of not being a licensed station. It cost many thousands of dollars to found and maintain a radio service which is on the legal up and up. And, of course, there's an annual fee that goes to the FCC for that. Legal privilege. That certainly says something about why we're not legal. But we have been... without a studio, still airing, broadcasting, and streaming our program through the magic of computer technology and a few of us who actually produced our programs on our personal computers or someone's PC laptop or whatever. For 9 months, we were without a studio. Well, we have a studio space once again. The search finally fruited out, and here we are. But before I return to the task of reading books, I want to read one more of these fascinating pamphlets that I picked up at the Justice for Palestine conference in Santa Cruz in April of this year, the last 2 days of this past April. A good 2 months ago. I picked up an S-load of these pamphlets from the If Americans Knew info table. And along the lines of the one that I finished last week, Origin of the Palestine-Israel Conflict, here is yet another title, which is A War for Israel. Again, the title is A War for Israel by Jeffrey Blankfort, photojournalist and Middle East analyst. Here's his back of the last page, biographical notes. Jeffrey Blankfort was raised in a Jewish non-Zionist family. He produces radio programs on three stations and has written extensively on the Middle East. He was formerly the editor of the Middle East Labor Bulletin and co-founder of the Labor Committee of the Middle East. His photographs of the anti-Vietnam War and Black Panthers movements have appeared in numerous books and magazines. It's after all my many decades of living, this is the first time I've come across the phrase, the anti-Vietnam War. Had me just a little befuddled for a few seconds until I realized that that title is right on. His photographs of the anti-Vietnam War and Black Panthers movements have appeared in numerous books and magazines. In February 2002, he won a lawsuit against the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, which was found, the ADL was found to have had a vast spying operation directed against American citizens opposed to Israel's policies in the occupied West Bank and Gaza of Palestine, and to the apartheid policies of the government of South Africa and passing on information to both governments. So the ADL, the Jewish Anti-Defamation League here in the United States, was found to have had a vast spying operation directed against American citizens who were opposed to Israel's policies and who were opposed to the apartheid policies of the government of South Africa. And ADL passed on information to the Israeli government and to the existing, at the time, apartheid government of South Africa, which would have been like, 2002. The former apartheid government of South Africa, of course, goes back to before the 1990s, or the switchover, I believe, occurred in the 1990s, but the suit wasn't won until 2002. And here's a quotation from Blankford. Quote, "Those in government who dissent and who insist that differences may exist between the security interests of the United States and the security interests of Israel can expect to be publicly trashed and called on the carpet by an Israeli-friendly congressional committee." I'll read that to you again. Jeffrey Blankford says, "Those in government who dissent and who insist that differences may exist between the security interests of the United States and those of Israel can expect to be publicly trashed and called on the carpet by an Israeli-friendly congressional committee." That's Blankfurt's single-sentence assessment of the congressional situation here in American government. Okay, this is the Mideast Migraines Program, not the Middle East, but the Mideast Migraines Program, which is what you would enter in the search box at radio4all.net for the archives of my programs. The podcast, which you can listen to at your own convenience where and when you like, Mideast Migraines, for Saturday, July 2, 2016. Let's get going on this pamphlet, A War for Israel. The text of it is some 34 pages long. Okay, grab your cup of coffee there. Make yourself comfortable. One more very quick comment here. It was on some chat room somewhere on the internet, I came across the sentiment by a pro-Israel person that, as they put it, Israel has never asked or demanded of the United States that the United States fight Israel's wars for it. This person claimed that Israel has never had to have the United States and has never asked the U.S. to fight Israel's wars. Keep that comment of mine in mind as we get into this booklet, A War for Israel by Jeffrey Blankford. A War for Israel, originally in Left Curve, issue number 28 by Jeffrey Blankford. Introduction. When Malaysian Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad declared at an international Islamic conference in Kuala Lumpur, capital of Malaysia, in mid-October 2013, that, quote, "Today the Jews rule the world by proxy, and they get others to fight and die for them," end quote. When the Prime Minister, Mahathir Mohamad, said that at the conference, the reactions in the U.S. and the West were predictable. It was, quote, "a speech that was taken right out of the Protocols of Zion," according to one Israeli commentator. And Mahathir would be accused of imitating Hitler and ensuring that, quote, "Muslims around the world are similarly being fed a regular diet of classic big lies about Jewish power. By the way, this booklet is extensively footnoted. All the footnotes are on the back here, so it would be a bit of a burden for me to constantly go back and forth. But I will say that this first sentence, today the Jews rule the world by proxy, and they get others to fight and die for them. That quotation is extracted from the New York Times, October 21, 2003. Continuing. Muslims around the world are similarly being fed a regular diet of classic big lies about Jewish power. Big lies? Given Israel's unchecked dominion over the Palestinians and its neighbor, its Arab neighbors, over the past half century, supported in every way possible by the United States, one can assume that Muslims, not to mention intelligent non-Muslims, have no need for additional instruction as to the extent of Jewish power. As further proof of its existence, if such were needed, there would be no attempt to measure the Malaysian Prime Minister's words against the reality of the times to determine if there was anything accurate in his assessment. If Mahathir, the PM of Malaysia, could be accused of anything, it would be of being sloppy historically and using too broad a brush. The Jews, in italics the here, the Jews, as such, control nothing. A segment of American Jewry, however, has been able, with few exceptions, to shape U.S. Middle East policy since the mid-60s. Given America's position as a major world power, and now its only superpower, that is not a small achievement. Over the years, that segment, the organized American Jewish community, in short, the Israel lobby, has amassed unparalleled political power through skillfully combining the wealth of its members with its extraordinary organizational skills to achieve what amounts to a corporate takeover of the U.S. Congress and virtual veto power over the presidency. Now, as you can hear, folks, I'm breaking away here from the text for a moment. This is mighty potent stuff. Whether you believe it or not, clearly this is the stuff of tremendous controversy, particularly in the United States, and especially bristling if you are a supporter of Israel. And I, for one, can easily see what people would say. Oh, this is just more of the Protocols of Zion. The Protocols of Zion, the actual title of the original work from over 100 years ago was The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which, according to material I have read, has been declared total fraud, historically speaking. There's no truth to it, etc., etc. I have never read the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, but I've got a feeling that much of its content is quite anecdotal and applicable to today's situation. Again, I have not read it. I've not been exposed to it. But that's my guess, my intelligent guess. Very potent stuff here, I know. If it makes you bristle, if it makes you want to turn the radio off, I highly suggest that you do not turn off your radio. One way or another, this is a form of education. True or false? Let's stick with it here and see what we come out with. Continuing now, I'll retrace the last paragraph. Over the years, that segment, the organized American Jewish community, in short, the Israel lobby, has amassed unparalleled political power through skillfully combining the wealth of its members, the American Jewish community, with its extraordinary organizational skills to achieve what amounts to a corporate takeover of the U.S. Congress and virtual power over the presidency itself. There is virtually no sector of the American body politic that has been immune to the lobby's penetration. that its primary goal has not been to improve the security and well-being of the United States or the American people, but to advance the interests of a foreign country, namely Israel, may be debated, but it was acknowledged in part more than a dozen years ago by Senator Howard Metzenbaum, Democrat of Ohio. Oh, pardon me. Maybe the devil is sabotaging my voice box here because I'm committing the egregious sin of complaining about the way Israel does. This stuff just emerges out of my lungs. Okay. Where was I? Senator Howard Metzenbaum, Democrat of Ohio, who complained to an annual conference of the National Jewish Community Relations Advisory Council that, and I quote, "There is only one issue members of Congress think is important to American Jews, Israel." It was no secret that Israel has long been interested in eliminating the regime of Saddam Hussein in Iraq and redrawing the map of the Middle East to enhance its power, Israel's power, in the region. Initiating that undertaking became a task for key individuals in and around the White House with deep roots in right-wing Israeli politics. The attack on the World Trade Center supplied the opportunity. That Iraq had nothing to do with it, with the World Trade Center attack, was immaterial. The lobby's propaganda apparatus would make the American people believe otherwise. The first step has been completed. Saddam Hussein has been removed, not by Israel, but by the U.S. and its, quote-unquote, coalition of the willing. From the perspective of the Israelis, and one must assume the lobby, it is better that American and foreign soldiers do the shedding of blood, Iraqi and their own, rather than those of Israel, the world's fourth-ranked military power. That's right, folks. Israel apparently has the world's fourth-ranked military power in size and or potency, and maybe by other measures. Continuing, such an accusation will most assuredly draw cries of blood libel from the likes of the Anti-Defamation League, but it is a conclusion that one can readily draw from the facts. The degree to which the present Iraq situation, as well as the first Gulf War, can be attributed to efforts of key individuals and the major Jewish organizations that constitute the lobby is what this article will examine. And then there is an asterisk. And right here on the same page, rather than in the list of footnotes, is the answer to the asterisk. The lobby's existence and power well predate its alliance with what may be called its Christian fundamentalist auxiliary, which has given it unprecedented influence over both Congress and the White House. Again, indeed, very potent stuff. Stick with it here, bear with, and learn. American soldiers of this setting of Lenore. On March 13, 2003, during a House Appropriations Subcommittee hearing on foreign aid, of which Israel has long been the dominant recipient, Secretary of State Colin Powell took the extraordinary step of assuring members of Congress that a, quote, small cabal of pro-Israeli American Jews was not orchestrating President George W. Bush's drive toward war. Powell assured members of Congress that these American Jews were not orchestrating Bush's drive toward war. Powell said the strategy with respect to Iraq has derived from our interest in the region and our support of United Nations resolutions over time. Powell said that in response to a question, question from the subcommittee's Republican chairman, Arizona Representative Jim Colby. And Powell continued to say, it is not driven by any small cabal that is buried away somewhere that is telling President Bush or me, Colin Powell, or Vice President Cheney, or National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, or other members of the administration what our policy should be, end quote. Jeffrey Blankford writes here, in fact, there is, in italics, there is a cabal that has been driving U.S. foreign policy under the Bush administration and some of its members, notably Elliot Abrams and Michael Ledeen, were part of the last cabal that operated in Washington under the Reagan administration, the one that brought us the Iran-Contra scandal. This one, however, is not nearly as secretive. Ironically, Powell has been and remains one of its favorite targets, and his frequent public humiliations at the cabal's hands have led seasoned observers to wonder why he hasn't resigned. Again, this is referring back to the year 2003, 13 years ago. Continuing, on this occasion, as he had on others, Powell played the loyal soldier, joining in what Haaretz's Nathan Gutman described as the Bush administration's, quote, every effort to play down Israel's role in the future military conflict, to remove any suspicion that the decision to go to war with Iraq is a pro-Israeli step. But as hard as the administration tries, Gutman wrote, the voices linking Israel to the war are getting louder and louder. It is claimed the desire to help Israel is the major reason for President George Bush sending American soldiers to a superfluous war in the Gulf. Close quote. Let me take a quick look at my magic box here. Checking on the listenership. Gee, how does he do that, folks? Okay, it's bigger than it was when I began the program some 49 and a half minutes ago. Okay, let's continue. I'm reading from a pamphlet entitled A War for Israel by American Jewish photojournalist and Mideast analyst Jeffrey Blankford. On this occasion, as he had on others, Powell played the loyal soldier. Okay, already read that. The loudest among them may have been the free-swinging, old-line, quote, conservative Pat Buchanan, who charged that a cabal of polemicists and public officials seek to ensnare our country in a series of wars that are not in America's interests. This is Pat Buchanan talking, folks. What these neoconservatives seek is to conscript American blood to make the world safe for Israel, Buchanan wrote in the March 24 issue of the magazine he edits, The American Conservative. This is what Buchanan was saying about whoever he thinks neoconservatives are. Because of his history of advocating right-wing causes, his comments were largely ignored by the forces mobilizing against the war. Another of those voices was syndicated columnist Robert Novak, who several months earlier had written that, quote, in private conversation with members of Congress, the former general, referring to Israel's Ariel Sharon, leaves no doubt that the greatest U.S. assistance to Israel would be to overthrow Saddam Hussein's Iraqi regime. Leaves no doubt that the greatest U.S. assistance to Israel at the time would be to overthrow Iraq's Saddam Hussein. That view is widely shared continuing the quotation now, inside the Bush administration, and is a major reason why U.S. forces today are assembling for war. That according to columnist Robert Novak. Support for a U.S. attack on Iraq was not limited to Sharon or his Likud party, Israeli political party, the Likud. In the September 12 dialogue with Rabbi William Berkowitz at the Center for Jewish History, former Israeli Labor Prime Minister and then Foreign Minister Shimon Peres was asked what he thought of the administration's response to Iraq. Peres, likening the situation to the next world war, replied, this is Shimon Peres speaking here, why speak about an attack when you were defending freedom as you did in World War I, World War II, and now in III, inferring World War III? The words of Shimon Peres. I don't think this is a campaign against Iraq, neither their people nor their land, but against a terrible killer, a dictator who already initiated two aggressive wars, one against Muslim Iran for 7 years at a cost of 1 million lives, and against an Arab Kuwait. Who saved Kuwait? The Arab League? Question, the Arab League? You gave Japan an improved Japan, and you gave Germany a better Germany and the Marshall Plan. I believe the strength of freedom is equal to the strength of the United States. I don't see anybody doing the job, so I justify the American position fully. The president speaks loud and clear. End quotation.
Ouch.
One may speculate whether Powell would have raised the issue had he not been asked, but apparently he felt the need to clear the air following an uproar that occurred 10 days earlier when Virginia Democratic Congressman Jim Moran claimed that if it were not for the strong support of the Jewish community for this war with Iraq, we wouldn't be doing this. As could be expected, his comment was condemned by the White House and congressional Democratic leaders, including Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle and Democratic House Whip Nancy Pelosi, two longtime loyal devotees of the Israeli cause. Six local rabbis and Washington Post columnist Mark Fisher called on him to resign, with the latter comparing the congressman's remarks to a speech Adolf Hitler delivered to the German parliament in 1939, accusing, quote, Jewish financiers of plunging Europe into a world war. American politician, was it Jim Moran? Moran is symptomatic of a problem that we have been watching for several weeks and months, lamented Abraham Foxman, national director of the Anti-Defamation League, ADL. Foxman continued, and that is that the change that the Jews are instigators and advocators of military action has moved from the extreme into the mainstream, end quote. This shift, he added, is emboldening people such as Moran to, quote, have the chutzpah to say such things. It's out there, and therefore we are concerned, Foxman said, and continued, if God forbid the war is not successful and the body bags come back, who's to blame? Fueling such anxieties, the Jewish Weekly Forward noted, was, quote, the increasing media focus on the White House's concern with protecting Israel and the views of Jewish hawks within the administration, end quote. Fueling the anxieties. While the mainstream press condemned Moran's remarks, columnist Michael Kinsley pointed out that the thunderous rush of politicians of all stripes to denounce Moran's remarks as complete nonsense might suggest to the suspicious mind that they are not complete nonsense, end quote, and that Jewish organizations are being hypocritical since they were posting comments on their own websites lauding the Israel lobby's ability to get things done. Wrote Kinsley the following two paragraphs: Moran is not the only one publicly exaggerating the power and influence of the Zionist lobby these days. It is my sad duty to report that this form of anti-Semitism seems to have infected one of the most prominent and respected, one might even say influential, organizations in Washington. This organization claims that America's pro-Israel lobby, as we all know what pro-Israel is a euphemism for, has tentacles at every level of government and society. Kinsley continues here, on its website, this organization paints a lurid picture of Zionists spreading their party line and even indoctrinating children. And yes, this organization claims that the influence of the Zionist lobby is essential to explaining the pro-Israel tilt of U.S. policy in the Middle East. And then this next sentence is entirely in italics. It asserts that the top item on the Zionist, quote, agenda is curbing the power of Saddam Hussein. Author Blankford added that emphasis. The website also contains a shocking collection of Moran-type remarks from leading American politicians. Okay, so as far as Michael Kinsley is concerned, I'm not sure. I'm a little lost. I'm not sure who he's referring to as an anti-Semitic organization. Continuing with Blankford's pamphlet here, the site he was referring to is that of AIPAC. The AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, Israel's official Washington lobbying arm, which, in testament to its power, is generally referred to in the halls of Congress simply as, quote, the lobby. AIPAC, American Israel Public Affairs Committee. From a one-man office, when it was founded 50 years ago, AIPAC has grown into an organization of 85,000 members with activists in every Jewish community in the United States. Each spring, it holds a national three-day conference in Washington. Writes forward editor J.J. Goldberg, its climactic congressional dinner attracts hundreds of Congress members and dozens of foreign ambassadors, all of them eager to curry goodwill with AIPAC and the Jewish community. Lest the point be lost, the dinner chairperson always reads a roll call naming every senator, every representative, and ambassador present in the hall, followed by private receptions by lawmakers courting Jewish campaign support, end quote. The organization does not contribute money to candidates directly, but advises numerous Jewish PACs, political action committees, and wealthy Jewish donors as to the campaigns where their money might be the most useful to Israel. AIPAC holds similar conferences, but on a smaller scale, around the country in the winter, with local officials from the representative regions being honored as invited guests. It so happens that AIPAC's annual conference last year followed the Iraq invasion by a week. So happened. Since, quote, AIPAC is wont to support whatever is good for Israel And so long as Israel supports the war, wrote Haaretz's Gutman, so too do the thousands of the AIPAC lobbyists who convened in the American Capitol. The Washington Post's Dana Milbank did not go quite that far, but noted that the meeting put a spotlight on the Bush administration's, quote, delicate dance with Israel and the Jewish state's friends over the attack on Iraq. While, quote, officially, he wrote, AIPAC had no position on the merits of a war against Iraq before it started, as delegates were heading to town, the group put a headline on its website proclaiming, Israeli weapons utilized by coalition forces against Iraq. The item featured a photograph of a drone with the caption saying the, quote, Israeli-made Hunter unmanned aerial vehicle is being used, quote, by U.S. soldiers in Iraq. Let's stop for a musical break. It's 3 minutes after 12 noon this Saturday, July 2nd. And I'm reading from the booklet, A War for Israel, by Jeffrey Blankfort. Here on the Mideast Migraine Show, Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, streaming online, live online at freakradio.org. Musical break.
يا من بحسنك تمن ما ترحم
ترحموني الحبيب ما ترحموني الحبيب ما ترحموني الحبيب يا ليتي وصلك يوم واسعد بلك بالخدود وصلك يوم واسعد بلد من الخدود يلي تشاد الورود يلي تشاد الورود قلبي بقربك يطيب قلبي بقربك يطيب قلبي بقربك يطيب عبدك ضناه الغرام ساهر وغيره ينام عبدك ضناه الغرام ساهر وغيره ينام يا زين هذا حرام يا زين هذا حرام لو صاح ماله مجيب لو صاح ماله مجيب لو صاح ماله مجيب الوصل غاية مناك اغمق صادك من ضنان الوصل غاية مناك بالله حقق رجاي بالله حقق رجاي من يقصدك ما يغيب من يقصدك ما يغيب من يقصدك ما يغيب يا ريم وادي تديم لطيف جسمك لطيف يا ريم وادي تديم لطيف جسمك لطيف ما شفت أنا لك وصيف في الناس شكلك غريب في الناس شكلك غريب في الناس شكلك غريب في الناس شكلك غريب في الناس شكلك غريب
يرنو 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 بدلال فيثير بأشواق ضم
Again, you've been listening to thought I heard something crashing to the floor. Crossing Borders album featuring Sahir Hattar in concert. That last item, let me see here. Track 8, Mischievous Loser, composed by Fouad Al Mistigawi, and of course this compact disc being produced in Minnesota most likely features local talent from Minnesota, Minneapolis, so you probably never heard of them, but in the spirit of giving proper credit where it's due, that was Mischievous Loser, composed by Fouad Al Mistigawi. Where are my glasses? straining to read this tiny lettering here. And that was preceded by Memories, composed by Mohammed Il Kasabehi. Violin and Taksim by Kim Salisbury. And before that, I believe we were listening to The Deer of Thaqif Valley. Thaqif Valley, composed by Tarak Abdul Hakim. This is the Mideast Migraines Program Weekend Edition, which comes to you every Saturday at 11 a.m. Pacific Daylight Time. The other edition of Mideast Migraines airs every Monday at 3 p.m. Pacific Time here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, streaming live at freakradio.org and broadcasting in 101.3 FM. When you do visit our website, freakradio.org, as I said earlier, you will find a link for our schedule and what we're about and lots of exciting things, including a few external links. And for donations as well, to donate to this wonderful, strictly grassroots pirate radio service, non-compliant with the FCC. We're in it for the truth and to pass the truth along to you. So you might want to consider donating checks and money orders payable to FRSC, Free Radio Santa Cruz. Just make the check out to FRSC. No cash, please. Checks and money orders only. Address to FRSC. Post Office Box 7811. Santa Cruz, as two words, Santa and then C-R-U-Z, California, or C-A, for all those people in on the other side of the sea in Africa, the Gobi Desert, who regularly listen to this program, etc. Zip code 95061. I'll give it to you again. Send your check or money order payable to FRSC to FRSC P.O. Box 7811, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Also on our website is a link to PayPal, so you can use that link to pay using the PayPal program, www.freakradio.org/donate.html. Let me give the phone number out, which I have is one thing I've neglected to do here. We have one phone line, and it's open, area code 831. Now, again, this is Santa Cruz County in California, on the coast here in California, area code 831-427-3772. 831-427-3772. Call me at any time in the roughly 36 minutes we have left of this program. You can also send a message to Mideast Migraines' email address, which is MideastMadness@gmx.com. G as in Galapagos, M as in Machiavellian, X as in XYZ, .com. Email to this radio program, MideastMadness@gmx.com. And, of course, don't forget radioforall.net. Four is the number four. For the archive of my recordings of previous programs. Not every last one is recorded because it's not because I forget, but something happens and the program dumps and crashes and the recording is lost, but at least you're getting a live performance here from me. Okay. Let's continue with today's reading. Free from Jeffrey Blankfort's A War for Israel. This is a roughly 34-page pamphlet distributed by If Americans Knew, ifamericansknew.org in Washington, D.C. I lost my page. Better grab one more sip of coffee here. Page 6, I think. Pick up the darn thing, and it's just like dropping your bookmark here. Pray to Israel. Okay, little paragraphical overlap here to get our bearings again. It's 12:27 p.m. Pacific time, by the way. Here we go. The Washington Post's Dana Milbank did not go quite that far, but noted that the meeting put a spotlight on the Bush administration's, quote, delicate dance with Israel and the Jewish state's friends over the attack on Iraq. While officially he wrote, AIPAC had no position on the merits of a war against Iraq before it started. As delegates were heading to town to Washington, D.C., the group put a headline on its website proclaiming Israeli weapons utilized by coalition forces against Iraq. The item featured a photograph of a drone with the caption saying the Israeli-made Hunter unmanned aerial vehicle is being used by U.S. soldiers in Iraq. AIPAC's website, I believe. Yeah. A parade of Israeli as well as top Bush administration officials, Powell, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, Political Director Kenneth Melman, Undersecretary of State John R. Bolton, one of the rare non-Jewish neocons, Bolton, and Assistant Secretary of State William Burns appeared before the AIPAC audience. The meeting, attended by about 5,000 people, according to Milbank, including half the Senate and a third of the House, was reportedly planned long before it became clear it would coincide with hostilities in Iraq. This is not about Iraq, AIPAC spokesman Josh Block insisted. This is about going to Congress and lobbying for the Israeli aid package. House Whip Pelosi, Nancy Pelosi, who had reversed her earlier tepid opposition to the war and was now on the bandwagon, made a point of condemning anyone who sought, quote, to place responsibility for this conflict on the American Jewish community. In her speech to AIPAC, she expressed America's unshakable bond with Israel in a variety of ways at least a dozen times. Echoing the neocon agenda, she condemned, quote, Syria's and Iran's bankrolling of terror and the development of weapons of mass destruction, which she declared to be a clear and present danger. There was a deja vu atmosphere about the AIPAC gathering. A dozen years earlier, following Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, AIPAC leaders acknowledged that the lobby, quote, had worked in tandem with the first Bush administration, Bush 41, to win passage of a resolution authorizing the president to commit U.S. troops to combat. A Wall Street Journal article at the time noted that the, quote, behind-the-scenes campaign avoided AIPAC's customary high profile in the Capitol and relied on activists calling sometimes from Israel itself to contact lawmakers and build on public endorsements by major Jewish organizations. Yes, we were active, AIPAC's director Tom Dine told the paper. These are the great issues of our time. If you sit on the sidelines, you have no voice. So, and to be sure, money had its role with Democrats who had benefited from large contributions from pro-Israel PACs, political action committees, being among the swing votes. Having, quote, pro-Israel liberals behind the resolution made it easier to hold moderate Republicans as well. While the U.S. Congress was divided over going to war in 1990, said retired Major General Mati Peled, a former Israeli Knesset member, and before his death a leader of the Israeli peace camp, Mati Peled said, "There is one place in the world which is longing for war, and that is Israel. Every commentator finds it is his duty to join the party of the warmongers. Arrogant statements about the slowness of the Americans are heard every day." End quote. One place in the world which is longing for war, and that is Israel. Anti-war activists paid no attention to such statements or to the activities of the Israel lobby then, nor have they since. While they chanted "No blood for oil" in national protest on October 25th, Kinsley, Michael Kinsley, a mainstream liberal, described the situation as the proverbial elephant in the room. Everybody sees it. No one mentions it. Coffee. El Burpo. reading from Jeffrey Blankfort's pamphlet here, A War for Israel. And again, I must apologize for him and the publishers for not providing a publication date. I think it would have been wise to include that. But again, the latest year mentioned in this booklet so far, and we're on page 7, was 2003. Continuing. A month before the war, the Forward, the Jewish Forward's Ami Eden, commenting on Kinsley's piece, noted that what was, quote, once only whispered in back rooms was lately splashed in bold characters across the mainstream media over Jewish and Israeli influence in shaping American foreign policy. Eden wrote, "In recent weeks, the Israeli Jewish elephant has been on a rampage, trampling across the airwaves and front pages of respected media outlets, including the Washington Post, the New York Times, the American Prospect, the Washington Times, the Economist, the New York Review of Books, CNN, and, of all people, MSNBC. For its encore," he added, "the proverbial pachyderm plopped itself smack in the middle of Meet the Press, NBC's top-rated Sunday morning news program." Again, these are the words of the Jewish Forward publications, Ami Eden. Now, about this Meet the Press presentation. It says here, long description, "It occurred on February 23rd when host Tim Russert read from a February 14 column by veteran journalist Arnaud de Boscrave, editor-at-large of the Washington Times, who argued that the, quote, strategic object of senior Bush administration officials," this would be the younger, Bush 43, senior Bush administration officials was to secure Israel's borders by launching a crusade against its enemies in the Arab world. According to veteran journalist Arnaud de Borsgrav. One of Russert's guests was Richard Perle, at the time chairman of the Defense Policy Board, a key advisory panel to the Pentagon, as well as a fellow of the influential pro-Israel American Enterprise Institute. Of perhaps even more significance, Perle had been a founder of JINSA, the Jewish Institute of National Security Affairs, a little-known neocon think tank that will be examined later in the article. Russert turned to Perle and addressed the question, "Can you assure American viewers across our country that we're in this situation against Saddam Hussein and his removal for American security interests?" And then came the bombshell. "And what would be the link in terms of Israel?" Russert's question. Both Perle and Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz, who has family in Israel, have been routinely described in the press as architects of the war on Iraq. So the question was addressed to the right person. Okay, that was regarding the Meet the Press show of February 23rd, 2003. Clearly, Perle was not prepared. Squirming slightly, he replied, "Well, first of all, the answer is absolutely yes. Those of us who believe that we should take this action if Saddam doesn't disarm..." Turning the master volume down here. I don't want to blow up our equipment. Well, first of all, the answer is absolutely yes. Those of us who believe that we should take this action if Saddam doesn't disarm, and I doubt that he's going to, believe it's in the best interest of the United States. I don't see what would be wrong with surrounding Israel with democracies. Indeed, if the whole world were democratic, we'd live in a much safer international security system because democracies do not wage aggressive wars. Cough, cough. My words there. Also, my words to you that this smacks of democratic fairy dust that we've heard so much about after lamenting the decision to attack Iraq in 2003. We were going to spread democratic fairy dust in the Arab world and grow democracies in the garden of international delight. Okay, back to the book. I'll leave that contradiction for another time and note. Let me read that again. I'll leave that contradiction for another time and note, as did the forwards Eden, that it was a startling question, especially when directed at Perle, the poster boy, along with Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz and Undersecretary of Defense Douglas Feith, for anti-Semitic critics who insist the United States is being pulled into war by pro-Likud Jewish advisors on orders from Jerusalem. But Russert is no David Duke, nor even a Patrick Buchanan. If Russert is asking the question on national television, then the toothpaste is out of the tube. The question has entered the discourse in elite Washington circles and is now a legitimate query to be floated in polite company. Okay, that is actually the actual end of the remarks on the Meet the Press episode in question. More coffee. I feel kind of desperate to not give it a chance to cool down here. I got to grab some more of these Fisherman Friend cough suppressant lozenges. They work pretty well. Fisherman's Friend. Kind of squeeze that effectual advertisement in there. Sorry, Free Radio Collective. I like Fisherman's Friend. What can I say? No, we don't generally do commercial advertisements. We do not do commercial advertisements. We only make cheap comments like the one that I just made. We reply on the donations of you, our listening community, and on each of us who produces and hosts programs, locally grown programs, on free radio. Members of the Free Radio Collective pay monthly dues to keep this operation afloat. Generally, we do not receive donations from the programs or program providers that we import and present to you from afar. Please donate to FRSC. Okay, continuing with Jeffrey Blankford's War for Israel. In a lengthy front-page story, the Washington Post's Robert Kaiser described what appeared to be an unprecedented political partnership between Ariel Sharon and George W. Bush, headlined "Bush and Sharon Nearly Identical on Mideast Policy." Kaiser wrote, "Over the past dozen years or more, supporters of Sharon's Likud party have moved into leadership roles in most of the American Jewish organizations that provide financial and political support for Israel." Again, referring to primarily, you know, well, as I said, American Jewish organizations in the name of Israel, a foreign country. "The leadership does not necessarily reflect overall Jewish opinion. A poll to gauge Jewish opinions on the war, conducted 1 month before it broke out, found that 56% of Jews were supportive of the war, which corresponded to that of the general public. The rate was said to be even higher immediately afterward, corresponding to increased support for the war among the American populace in general." Concern about appearances, however, had earlier led members of the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish American Organizations, a Jewish umbrella group with 52 member organizations, to refrain from taking a bellicose stand. Concern about appearances there. "Just as we have not issued a public statement, we do not think it's the right time for the President's Conference to issue a public statement either," American Jewish Committee Executive Director David Harris told The Forward in October of 2002. And in italics, quotation, "Our interest here is to not be out ahead of the administration." Blankford's emphasis added. "Our interest here is not to be out ahead of the administration." In contrast, the liberal American Jewish Congress had no such reservations, said Jack Rosen, president of the American Jewish Congress, to the paper. "The final statement ought to be crystal clear in backing the president. Having to take unilateral action, if necessary, against Iraq to eliminate weapons of mass destruction." Jack Rosen's words. The AJ Congress had already issued its own position supporting the, quote, U.S. administration in its stated position to intervene in Iraq to ensure that Iraq is no longer a threat. But already in March of 2002, Mortimer Zuckerman, the chair of the Jewish President's Conference and editor-publisher of U.S. News and World Report and the New York Daily News, had made his position clear. He was supporting the administration's budding plan to remove Saddam, saying, "The next target in the war's phase clearly will be Iraq. The West's last lackluster efforts at non-proliferation have done little more than delay the inevitable, a Baghdad with nuclear weapons." The United States is prepared to take the risks and is right to do so in forcing a change in Iraq. By late October, he was eager to get it on, saying, "The only way to force Iraq to get rid of its terrible weapons is to rid the country of the regime that builds them. Washington must not pause in its push to depose Saddam. We are in a war against terrorism, and we must fight that war in the time and place of our choosing. The war's next phase clearly is Iraq." Zuckerman would write 6 more editorials in the weeks leading up to the war, each one more emphatic than the one before it, calling for Saddam's head. If Zuckerman's opinions carried unusual weight, it was because the Conference of Presidents is the Jewish body whose task it is to lobby the White House and the executive branch while AIPAC focuses on Congress. You may recall the words that I immediately preceded this reading with. It was suggested on some past message board chat room thing from at least one source that I came across that supposedly Israel has never asked the United States to fight its wars for it. And the United States, according to this person, has never had to fight Israel's war for it. I asked you to keep that in mind. Hopefully that is becoming clear now. More coffee. And it's 12:48 p.m. Pacific time. Good coffee. Continuing. As could be expected, accusations that Israel and its supporters within the government, the U.S. government, were orchestrating U.S. policy towards Iraq led to accusations of anti-Semitism and raised questions as to what extent criticism of Israel, American Jews, and Jewish officials working in the White House would be tolerated. Lawrence Kaplan, senior editor of the New Republic magazine, declared that references to Jewish and Israeli pro-war pressure were reminiscent of Buchanan's claims in 1990 that only soldiers with non-Jewish names would be killed in a war being pushed solely by Israel and its American, quote, amen corner. The ADL's Foxman told the Forward that while it was legitimate to raise questions concerning the pro-Israel leanings of certain administration officials, it was obligatory to note that not all the hawks were Jewish, and it was most definitely not kosher to portray these individuals and Jewish organizations as composing, and I quote, a shadowy Jewish conspiracy that controls American foreign policy. Not kosher to say that. Foxman said, "It is an old canard that Jews control America and American foreign policy." During both world wars, anti-Semites said that Jews manipulated America into war. So when you begin to hear it again, there is good reason for us to be aware of it and sensitive to it. Foxman was correct regarding the world wars, but this time there seems to be more than enough proof that a significant number of Jewish aficionados of Israel played a decisive part in getting the U.S. to invade and occupy Iraq. Retired General Anthony Zinni, former head of the military's Central Command, which includes the Middle East, appeared to be on the same page as Mahathir, again referring to Mahathir Mohamad, the Prime Minister of Malaysia. Details of his comment opening this pamphlet. Zini first raised questions about attacking Iraq in 1998, suggesting that a, quote, fragmented, chaotic Iraq could happen if this isn't done carefully, which is more dangerous in the long run than a contained Saddam is now. A warning that caused Wolfowitz, then a dean at Johns Hopkins, but acted behind the scenes to attack him in print. Zinni was simply reiterating what had been the policy of the first Bush administration, and that prior to the attack on Saddam had been repeated not only by former members of the elder Bush's cabinet, such as Secretary of State James Baker and National Security Advisor Brent Snowcroft here. I believe the name was Scowcroft. But by the elder Bush himself. And then in parentheses, Blankford says, this is worth noting because the first Bush and members of his administration had strong ties to the oil-producing countries as well as the industry. And had this truly been, quote, a war for oil, they could have been expected to support it. As it happened, those who insisted that it was about oil ignored this apparent flaw in their argument. Trying to control volume levels here to appropriate levels. As the Washington Post reported, the more he listened to Wolfowitz and other administration officials talk about Iraq, the more Zinni became convinced that interventionist neoconservative ideologues were plunging the nation into a war in a part of the world they didn't understand. Saying, I think the American people were conned into this. I don't know where the neocons came from. This wasn't the platform they ran on. Somehow the neocons captured the president. They captured the vice president, referring to Dick Cheney. 10, 11. Zinni is a hard target for the U.S. media that Mathahir, so most of the pro-war shills in the mainstream media choose to ignore him. Not, however, Joel Mowbray, a right-wing ideologue from the National Review, whose attack on Zinni appeared online. Here is the attack. Discussing the Iraq War with the Washington Post last week, former General Anthony Zinni took the path chosen by so many anti-Semites. He blamed it on the Jews. Technically, the former head of the Central Command in the Middle East didn't say Jews. He instead used a term that has become a new favorite for anti-Semites, neoconservatives. As the name implies, neoconservative was originally meant to denote someone who is a newcomer to the right. In the 90s, many people self-identified themselves as neocons in the 90s, but today that term has become synonymous with Jews, quote, Jews. According to Joel Mowbray of the National Review. And let me see. Okay, I think I'm going to... let me go a little farther here. It's less than a page of the next section here. Rather than distinct chapters, it's sections, as I pointed out, as the term that I use, are simply broken up with a new paragraph having the first letter of the first sentence super capitalized. Despite Mowbray's assertion that to criticize the neocons is thinly disguised anti-Semitism, he is correct in noting that the term has become synonymous with a certain group of Jews, the minuscule handful that are not, such as former CIA chief James Woolsey, longtime Washington insider Frank Gaffney, former Congressman Newt Gingrich, and Undersecretary of State John Bolton are unabashed Israelophiles. minuscule handful of sudden. Russian-born Max Boot, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and a contributing editor to the Weekly Standard, a veritable neocon house organ, the Weekly Standard, did not wait for Zinni's comments to realize that the inevitable criticism of the neocon's role in producing the Iraq quagmire had to be stopped. It is a, quote, malicious myth that the, quote, Bush administration is pursuing a neoconservative foreign policy. Boot wrote in Foreign Affairs, if only it were true. Showing contempt for the intelligence of his readers, he trotted out one of the weaker arguments the neocons have used in their defense, that while their numbers in the Bush administration, quote, seems impressive, it also reveals that the neocons have no representative in the administration's top tier. Parentheses. Bush advisor Karl Rove is technically not there either, but no one would argue that he carries no clout with the president. Wrote Boot, the contention that the neocon faction gained the upper hand in the White House has a superficial plausibility. Because the Bush administration toppled Saddam Hussein and embraced democracy promotion in the Middle East, end quote. But these policies, he would have us believe, are not the result of neocon cajoling, but rather an outgrowth of the September 11 attacks and the decision by Bush that the U.S., and I quote, no longer could afford a humble foreign policy. That's their spin. Let's see how well it holds up in the light of the facts. And spelling that out is going to have to wait until next Saturday at 11 a.m. Pacific. We're at the top of page 13 of this 34-page booklet. Far less than half, not terribly far less than half, but maybe we can get it done by next Saturday, and then I can get into the next real full-length book reading by a different author on a different subject. And again, I know this guy... very learned individual, this Jeffrey Blankford, who is also highly opinionated, and he does get into the mucky-muck about all this stuff, the who's who and the whys and wherefores for their positions. So again, this is another reading that's not terribly easy to follow, but clearly to me anyway, very vital work, vital piece of work. Okay, that's it for today's show. Until next Saturday at 11 a.m., or of course... if you wish, you may join the Monday edition of Mideast Migraines at 3 p.m., 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Monday, every Monday, here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Yeah, that's where I live, more or less. Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, streaming live at freakradio.org. Don't forget to visit our website, freakradio.org. Don't forget, you may send a message to Mideast Migraines. No, sorry, I blew it again. Send your email to MideastMadness@gmx.com. And don't forget to go to my archives at www.radioforall.net. Thank you so much once again. Till next time, do what you can, but behave yourself. And put this away for now. What else do we have coming up here? Let's go to the top of the thing here.
Commander.
Yes, come in, number one. Sit down.